Hey, Prime members, you can listen to this podcast early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to another episode of The Fall of Rome. As always, I'm your host, Patrick Wyman. Thanks for joining me today. When Theodosius the Great, the last emperor to rule both the eastern and the western halves of the empire, if only briefly, died at Milan in 395 following a crushing victory over the usurper Eugenius, there was good reason to think that things would turn out all right. Theodosius's two sons were young and inexperienced. Arcadius, who took over in the east, was 17, and Honorius, who would rule the west, was 10. But there was still no reason to think that the empire was in real trouble. There hadn't been a major border incursion in years, and Theodosius had signed a long-lasting peace with the Sassanid king Shapur III a decade earlier. The frontiers were strong and well-defended. The army, while weakened by the internecine slaughter of the Battle of the Frigidus and the Civil War of 394, was at the peak of its effectiveness in the late period. The economy was booming, with trans-Mediterranean trade reaching a peak of scale and integration in the years around 400. The imperial court and bureaucracy were effective, if ponderous, institutions that kept an increasingly tight grip on the society and finances of the empire. Still, there were signs of a few cracks. Northern Gaul, and especially Britain, were slipping from the empire's grasp, and while these were, and always had been, somewhat marginal areas, it certainly wasn't a good sign. The prospect of rule by a 10-year-old minor in the west and by a 17-year-old youth who had shown few signs of burgeoning brilliance in the east had no positive precedence in the history of the Roman Empire. Just over 80 years later, the empire in the west had disappeared as a political unit. Kingdoms ruled by barbarians controlled the entirety of what had once been its territory. Anglo-Saxon migrants and British aristocrats were carving up what had once been the Roman province of Britain. Franks ruled the northern stretches of Gaul in competition with Roman warlords. Visigothic kings had been planted in southern Gaul for 60 years, and the Burgundians had built a kingdom for themselves around Geneva and Vienne. Suaves held northwest Spain, and the Vandals controlled North Africa with an iron fist. Even Italy was under the control of a barbarian warlord, Odoacer, and his multi-ethnic army. The empire in the west was gone. How did this happen? How did an empire that had lasted for hundreds of years collapse over the course of one long lifetime? That's what we'll explore in today's episode. I'm Patrick Wyman, and this is The Fall of Rome. So over the course of this show, you've probably noticed that there have been precious few generals, kings, and emperors in the account that I've given, and the form of that account has never taken the form of a straightforward, overarching political narrative. There are a few reasons for this. The first is that political narratives of Rome's fall are pretty common, and I didn't want to start off this show just by doing something that others have done before, many times very well. On top of that, starting with one shapes your sense of what's important, that high politics are the determinant of everything else that happens. It becomes the basic structure through which we understand everything else. Second, I don't think a political narrative by itself conveys the depth or complexity of how the fall of the Roman Empire actually played out, even just politically. That's one of the arguments that I've made here. A narrative forces us to impose a particular order and focus on events and processes, and a single one of them can't capture the diversity of how the fall played out in all the different regions of the empire. Finally, and most importantly, I don't think that straightforward political narratives really capture all that much about history as a whole. They tend to focus on the great men at the very top of the social ladder, on emperors, kings, generals, popes, the very elite of the elite. They're structured around events, whether a battle, a coup, an invasion, or the crafting of a law. The sense of causality, of why things happen, that a political narrative can provide is necessarily then based around events involving a political elite. At a really basic level, that's just not how I approach history. Unlike some historians with the kind of insufferably postmodern leanings that were in vogue 15 or 20 years ago, I have nothing against narratives in and of themselves. I've given you many different narratives over the course of this show on everything from the migration of the Goths, to the rise of the Hunnic Empire, to the life of a woman in the British countryside, but with that said, we have to pick them very carefully and understand their limitations as well as their value. as ways of understanding why things happen at the highest political level and the big events that arise from them, I tend to prefer structures and institutions rather than narratives of events driven by big men. There's a really great quote from the French historian Fernand Braudel that sums up how I tend to think about these things. He calls history of these kinds of events the froth on top of the waves, quote, surface disturbances, crests of foam that the tides of history carry on their strong backs. Now, I tend to agree with that, and that's why, to this point, I've avoided giving you that one narrative that supersedes all others, the master narrative of politics and war. Now, with all of that said, I'm going to spend this episode working through a political narrative of the big events and the most important people of the 5th century. At this point in the show, if you've been listening along, you've gotten enough of Braudel's big underlying tides that the foam isn't going to wash you away into the abyss. You can place this narrative of high politics in the proper context of institutions, structures, and regional difference and get why it matters without letting it overwhelm everything else. And believe me, it does matter, because the sheer chaos that came about as the result of things happening at the highest level of politics is a strong argument in favor of contingency and luck in our conception of history. It matters. It's just not the only thing that matters, or the most important thing. So this political narrative, then, is going to be the basic framework that's going to help us understand the next 6 or 8 episodes of this show when we talk in depth about the various political changes of the 5th century and beyond. We'll meet the people, ethnic groups, and eventually the kingdoms that would set the tone for the next several centuries, and we'll familiarize ourselves with the timeline of events just so we can keep things in proper order, understand what's happening when. There are going to be a lot of names and dates, and I'll do my best to keep it to just the essentials here before we dig in later. If you'd like a more thorough and detailed single narrative than what I'm providing, I'd suggest Guy Housel's outstanding book, Barbarian Migrations in the Roman West, or in audio form, the relevant episodes of Mike Duncan's History of Rome podcast. Oh, and one final note, something that we'll have to be aware of over the course of this episode. Political narratives of this kind are only as sound as the materials that you use to build them. Political narratives of necessity draw mostly on written sources, with the occasional assist from archaeology, and the written sources for the 5th century are thin, confusing, and often downright contradictory. I'll try to indicate what's more or less solid, but we have to be aware of how shaky the foundation of our narrative can often be. It's just a whole bunch of things stitched together from a whole bunch of different sources that aren't necessarily solid. So, with all of these caveats in mind, let's come back to Theodosius and the empire he left on his death in 395. It was Theodosius who brought the initial war with the Goths to an end after the Battle of Adrianople when he took over the eastern half of the empire, while first Gratian and then Valentinian II ruled in the west. The east was pretty stable during Theodosius's reign, but the same can't be said for the west. Gratian was murdered in 383, and a usurper came over from Britain. His name was Magnus Maximus, and took things over for a while. We met Magnus Maximus back in episode 6 of this show, on Britain, and we talked about how him pulling troops away from Britain accelerated the financial crisis on the island. Magnus Maximus, once he got over to Gaul, ruled from Trier, the northern capital, for 5 full years. This might seem a bit strange, but as long as he kept to the north of the Alps and didn't cause trouble for the non-entity Emperor Valentinian II in Ravenna, Theodosius was inclined to let Magnus Maximus just kind of do his thing, and Theodosius and Valentinian II even officially recognized Magnus Maximus as an imperial colleague for a little while. That changed, obviously, when Magnus Maximus invaded Italy, and Theodosius defeated his armies twice in the Balkans. Maximus himself was killed outside Aquileia, and his whole family was purged. Valentinian II didn't last long after that, dying in 392 under mysterious circumstances, and I'd argue that that was when the real trouble started. Valentinian II's master of soldiers, a Frank named Arbogast, took over and appointed a puppet emperor named Eugenius. Theodosius wasn't just going to let that stand, and so he fought and won a terrible battle at the Frigidus River over Eugenius and Arbogast, establishing himself as the sole emperor before dying the next year in 395. Now, why do I say this was when the trouble started? Well, for a few different reasons, but mostly because the seeds of pretty much everything that went wrong later were planted before or during Theodosius's reign. What happened afterward just watered and cultivated and nurtured those seeds until they blossomed fully. First, the Battle of the Frigidus effectively tore the heart out of the army of the Western Empire. There was just no replacing all those experienced, long-service professional troops who died in the Civil War. This shortage of reliable troops would have serious consequences in the very near future. Second, many of the soldiers in the Eastern Army who died at the Frigidus were Goths who had been settled after the Battle of Adrianople. The fact that they had been used as what amounted to cannon fodder in a Roman civil war was one of the reasons they rebelled in 395 under the leadership of Alaric. Third, and most important, the battle left Theodosius in sole charge of the empire. When he died, it was his two young and ultimately completely feckless sons who took over, the 10-year-old Honorius in the west and the 17-year-old Arcadius in the east. If you think back to episode 5, when I talked about the structures of the empire in the 4th century, I argued that it was basically sound as long as there was a competent adult emperor in charge. Why? It was an increasingly centralized state, and at the center of that state, you needed a functional, competent adult who could dispense patronage and make decisive decisions, especially military ones. There was no way that a 17-year-old with no experience and a 10-year-old child could do that. Everything went downhill from here. And if we want to place some blame on somebody with the benefit of hindsight, Theodosius, frankly, should have known better. So three things happened almost immediately after the death of Theodosius. First, the Eastern and the Western imperial courts got themselves into a spat about who exactly was supposed to be in charge, with the Western general Stilicho claiming that Theodosius had in fact left him in charge of both of the young emperors, not just Honorius in the West. Second, the Goths rebelled, and under the leadership of the formidable Alaric, immediately inserted themselves into these complex court politics. Third, though its full importance wouldn't be recognized for a while, the Huns launched their first major incursions into Roman territory. They ravaged both the Balkans and, a whole world away, swooped down through the passes of the Caucasus into Armenia and even all the way into Syria. Internal unrest at the highest levels was becoming a real problem in the East. A series of court intrigues led to the exile of senior ministers and the exile and then assassination of a general, and this is partially what drove Alaric and the Goths out of the east and toward the west, where they'd make their fortune. We don't need to cover this here in detail. If you want to listen, you can go back to episode 4 for more depth. But suffice to say that Stilicho and Alaric fought a whole series of battles, and Alaric eventually ended up accepting a military command in Pannonia and taking his Goths with him. This was 402. So now, the events of 405 and 406 threw a serious wrench into the gears of the Western Empire. A large force of Goths, led by a king named Radagaisus, probably refugees from the increasingly powerful Hunnic Empire beyond the Danube, invaded Italy in 406. Stilicho defeated them in a decisive battle and took so many captives that the bottom of the slave market fell out. The great Stilicho didn't have any answers for the other great invasion of that year, though. On December 31st, 405, a huge body of Vandals, Alans, and Sueves crossed the Rhine into Gaul. The Franks manning the frontier, Roman allies for quite some time, fought them for a while, but couldn't hold back the waves of barbarian invaders. The Rhine frontier effectively disintegrated, and the wolves were in the henhouse. This was the context that produced the last great usurpation in the West. The army units stationed in Britain, or whatever was left of them, raised one of their generals to the purple. This man, Constantine III, took the remaining units of the field army out of Britain and into Gaul, where he rapidly succeeded in containing the Vandals, the Alans, and the Sueves all up in the north. All of Gaul pretty quickly submitted to Constantine III. By 408, further court intrigues left Stilicho dead, and Alaric and his Goths were without a bargaining partner. The Goths entered Italy for a second time and soon thereafter sacked Rome in 410, having been left with no better alternatives in the absence of real negotiations with the Emperor Honorius and the imperial court in Italy. Alaric died shortly after this sack in 410 and was succeeded by his brother-in-law Ataulf, who took the title, we think, of King of the Goths. This would have been a novel step. Whatever Alaric had been, whatever the Goths had been before this, an army or refugees or a people on the move, they were in the process of becoming basically a mobile kingdom led by a defined king. This is something very different than an army. But after two more years of ravaging Italy so severely that the tax burden of Campania was reduced by 90% in recognition of their struggles, Ataulf finally took the Goths north into Gaul. At this point, in 412, Constantine III wasn't doing especially well. His attempts to extend his rule from Gaul into Spain hadn't been successful, and as a nice little cherry on top, the Vandals, Alans, and Sueves that he was supposed to be fighting had escaped through the passes of the Pyrenees into Iberia, where they soon set themselves up. Constantine himself was eventually captured in Gaul, and then executed shortly thereafter, while yet another usurper first found the support of, and then was betrayed by, Athelwulf and the Goths. So at this point, Athelwulf decided to play the game of high politics at the highest possible level. He married himself to Galla Placidia, the daughter of Theodosius, and seems to have decided to make himself a new Stilicho, the kind of the power behind the throne. That didn't last long, though. Athelwulf was assassinated in 415, and the new Gothic king, Wallia, placed himself in Roman service to fight the Vandals, Alans, and Sueves in Iberia. They didn't really have many more options at this point in time. The Goths succeeded dramatically. They crushed one of the two branches of the Vandals and the Alans. In return for their service, the new power behind the Western Imperial throne, a man named Constantius, settled the Goths in Aquitaine around the city of Toulouse.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
All this month, we're asking you to tell a friend about a podcast they'll love. Right now, think of a friend, your mom, your coworker, anyone you care about. What podcast would they really love? Got it? Now do it. Tell them about it in real life or on social media, and if they don't know about podcasts, show them how. Remind them that podcasts are free and they're right there on their phone. Tell us what you recommended with the hashtag TryPod, TryPod, for Try a Podcast. Thanks so much for spreading the word. So, if this situation around the year 420 seems confusing, that's because it should be confusing. The whole picture we get is one of tangled loyalties, wandering groups of militarized barbarians occasionally working for the Roman Imperial government, or a faction within the Roman Imperial government. There are constant usurpations, there's endemic violence, and there's civil war. It's pure, bloody chaos. So let's stop here for a moment to take stock of everything and get our bearings. In 420, Honorius was still emperor in the West. Arcadius had died in the east back in 408, leaving yet another minor, his young son Theodosius II, in charge. Both courts were effectively controlled by ministers and counselors, and while Honorius was by this point 35 years old, he had shown zero sign of being willing or able to take control of his court and government. Theodosius II was just 7 when he came to the throne, and while he would eventually become a force in his own right, he was just coming into adulthood here. Both were dominated by the most important figures in their courts, especially the generals. One recent account of this period calls it the rise of the generals, or the domination of the generals. Now, geographically speaking, the Western Empire had begun to contract. Britain had been slipping for central control for a while already by 400, and by 420, it had effectively passed the point of no return, as individual warlords of Saxon or Romano-British descent were carving it up into what might eventually become independent kingdoms. Northern Gaul was kind of a gray area. Technically, it was still Roman, but there hadn't been much in the way of central government there for at least 15 years, if not longer. Roman and Frankish warlords were more or less in charge at a local level. At this point, the Loire River in roughly the middle of Gaul marked the boundary of effective imperial control. What was left of Gaul was basically a rump, and the Rhine frontier too seemed to be mostly under the control of local warlords of barbarian descent. They might have an official Roman title, but they were effectively barbarian warlords. Now, the Goths at this point had been settled around the city of Toulouse in southwestern Gaul. Whether it seemed like it at the time, and the few indications that we have are that it didn't, this was a major turning point. It was the first settlement of an independent group of barbarians in Roman territory. A large chunk of Iberia, the most economically important part of the Mediterranean coast, had been returned to imperial control, but the Vandals, the Alans, and the Sues were still viable entities that exercised some form of rule, we're not exactly sure what, over a large chunk of the peninsula. The fringes of the African provinces, too, seemed to be slipping from the control of the Western imperial court, though its major cities were still closely tied to the center politically and, as we've talked about at very great length, economically. So we'll discuss these barbarian settlements at much greater length in future episodes, but I just want to hit one important general point before we move back to the narrative, and that's tax revenues. Britain and northernmost Gaul had probably always cost more to defend than they ever brought in, but this absolutely wasn't the case for the parts of Gaul that were slipping out of reach or where the Goths had been settled. Outside of remote central and northwestern Iberia, that wasn't the case there either. Usurpations like that of Constantine III took all the revenues of all those regions away from the government in Ravenna, and a state that screwed up probably wasn't doing a good job of collecting the taxes it was due, even in the regions that it still firmly controlled politically. All of this meant that the imperial government was drastically falling short of the money it needed to run its bureaucracy, and especially its army. The Roman army, as we discussed at great length in episode 10, couldn't run without a complex logistical and financial system that moved goods, money, and people from place to place in huge numbers and quantities. Take away the taxes that they were collecting in cash or in kind, and you take away everything that allowed the Roman Empire to have a standing professional army, one of the things that set it apart from every other state. Without a standing professional army, well, that's how you end up granting away a productive area like Aquitaine in return for the Goths' future military service. It was a vicious cycle. So, let's get back to the narrative here. Honorius died in 423, one of the least effective and actively harmful emperors in the history of Rome, and after a two-year usurpation, he was replaced by his six-year-old nephew, Valentinian III. That usurpation and the accession of Valentinian III is mostly notable for the rise of the famous general Aetius, whom we met briefly in the episode on the Huns. Aetius would dominate what remained of the Western Empire for the next 30 years. The reason Aetius came up in that episode on the Huns was because he had grown up among the Huns as kind of a high-value hostage. His rise to power in the West was intimately connected to his use of Hunnic troops as effectively a private mercenary army to maintain something like control over the Western Empire. When the Goths threatened the city of Arles in southern Gaul, Aetius took an army of Huns to the province and drove them back toward Toulouse. He then went north and, we're told, campaigned against the Franks along the Rhine, though what that means we're not exactly sure. Why he fought the Franks and precisely where he fought them is unknown, though Aetius seems to have pushed deep into that territory north of the Loire that had been slipping from Roman rule for decades now. Disaster struck soon after Aetius' campaigns. For a few years now, the Vandals had been making an increasing nuisance of themselves in Iberia, defeating a Roman army and establishing themselves as the masters of the productive area of southern Spain. At some point, they acquired ships and started to raid. They raided the Balearic Islands and the coast of North Africa. Around the year 429, it may have been as early as 427, the Vandals picked up stakes and headed across the Straits of Gibraltar for Africa, the wealthiest region of the Western Empire, where they would spend the next decade looting and burning their way from the Atlantic to Carthage. Things got a bit messy here. The governor of Africa, a man named Boniface, tried and failed to defeat the Vandals. For some reason, it's not entirely clear why, he fell out with Aetius, and, as the Vandals were still rampaging across the coast of North Africa, he brought his army over to Italy. Boniface briefly defeated Aetius, but died of his wounds soon after that, which left Aetius the unquestioned master of the Western Empire, the one without an effective army or a governor in North Africa. Aetius, despite all the power he'd accrued, had no real interest in being the emperor. The title he ended up taking was Magister Utriusque Militiae, the master of both services, meaning effectively that he was the supreme general in the West. Now at this point, they were forced to grant the Vandals a treaty that granted them the control of the provinces of Mauritania and Numidia, effectively removing two rich provinces from the control of the Roman state. Spain was a chaotic mess, with the Sueves operating freely in the northwest and a lack of central control even in the regions that the Sueves weren't present in. Aetius was forced to make a treaty with them, too, at roughly the same time, simply because he didn't have a better option for dealing with the Sueves. Now, to his credit, Aetius didn't accept this state of affairs lying down. By the mid-430s, the Burgundians had established a kingdom somewhere along the Middle Rhine. Where exactly is hard to say. Using Hunnic troops, Aetius swooped down on the Burgundians and so thoroughly destroyed their kingdom that the memory of that loss formed the core of the much later classic medieval Nibelungenlied epic poem. Aetius didn't stop there, attempting to reestablish some semblance of a frontier along the Rhine and campaigning throughout northern Gaul. One of his subordinates led a campaign against the restless Goths, who were again trying to extend their territory out from Toulouse and toward Narbonne and Arles along the Mediterranean, and Aetius' subordinate had some success in containing them. In 439, though, utter disaster struck. Everything else that had happened before this, if it seemed bad, this was by far the worst. The Vandal king Gaiseric captured Carthage in a surprise attack, and the rest of the North African heartland followed shortly thereafter, cutting off once and for all the richest agricultural region of the Western Empire from the political core in Italy. Now remember, North Africa is where the grain and the olive oil that supplied the city of Rome were produced. It was one of the two anchors in the tax spine that bound the whole Western Empire together. It is impossible to overstate what a crushing blow this was. To make matters even worse, Sicily, the Balearic Islands, Sardinia, and Corsica all fell to the Vandals shortly thereafter. An attempt to recapture Sicily and then North Africa went absolutely nowhere. The knock-on effects of the capture of Carthage and the loss of North Africa on the rest of the Western Empire were absolutely enormous. To deal with that Vandal threat, Aetius was forced to sign a formal peace treaty with the Goths who were around Toulouse. This was a huge deal. Why? Because it looks more like a bilateral agreement than one between a subordinate group and a governing authority, and it may have even recognized the Goths' rule by a king. Shortly after the signing of this treaty, we see the first definite signs of the Goths pursuing what looks like an independent foreign policy on their own, as the king married his daughters to the king of the Sueves and then to the heir to the Vandal throne. The Sueves soon broke out of their core territories in the northwest of Spain and took Mérida and even Seville shortly after that. As if that weren't enough, the Huns launched a huge invasion into the Balkans in 441. This was the first major action of Attila the Hun's career. The city of Sirmium, the hinge of the whole line of defense around the Danube, was razed to the ground, as were several other important cities like Nisus and Serdica, today's Nice and Sofia in Bulgaria. Between the Vandals, the Sueves, and the Goths, large chunks of the core areas of the empire were starting to slip away by 445, not just the periphery like northern Gaul or Britain. Independent kingdoms were in the process of becoming the rulers of the most productive areas of the West, from Carthage to Seville to Toulouse. The Danube frontier was effectively gone and was better understood at this point as the periphery of the Hunnic Empire rather than the border of the Roman Empire. Aetius spent the rest of the 440s trying desperately to hang on to what remained of the West in this vastly different political situation. He made use of Vandal and Gothic allies wherever possible, with limited success against the Sueves in Spain and somewhat more success as he tried to re-extend Roman rule to the north of the Loire and all the way to the Rhine. By 450, Aetius had succeeded in re-establishing some semblance of Roman control in northern Gaul, wrangling the Frankish and the Roman warlords who had stepped into the power vacuum in the previous half-century. That's precisely when Attila made his first move to the west, justifying it by means of an intervention in a Frankish succession dispute and, more exotically, to claim the sister of the Emperor Valentinian III in marriage. In 451, the Hunnic king took an enormous army into Gaul, not just Huns, but also Goths, Gepids, Scyri, Rugians, and many others. Without much in the way of opposition, Attila rampaged through northern Gaul, sacking Metz and Reims and besieging a number of other cities, including Orléans. To defeat Attila, Aetius assembled a coalition of the willing that showcased just how much the Western Empire had changed in the last 50 years. The Goths, soon to be the Visigoths of Toulouse, and the Burgundians Aetius had settled along the Rhone were one component, while the Franks of northern Gaul were another. Whatever remained of the regular Roman army was along for the ride as well, but it's clear from our thin, scanty sources that they were an afterthought in comparison to the allied contingents. The two armies met in a cataclysmic battle on the Catalaunian plains to the east of Paris. They fought to a standstill, and while this has been historically claimed as a victory for Aetius and his coalition, we should probably see this as a draw. Attila had done what he set out to do, and with both armies badly mauled, it was prudent to withdraw. At any rate, the death of the Visigothic king Theodoric meant that his son and heir Thorismund had to withdraw to Toulouse to consolidate his rule anyway. Even if Aetius had wanted to pursue Attila, he couldn't have. Attila was back at it in 452. He invaded Italy and razed the city of Aquileia so thoroughly that the floor of its basilica still shows the scorch marks, and then he took Pavia and Milan. Just as he was heading south for Rome, Pope Leo the Great met him with a legation and, according to legend, convinced Attila to turn around. It's more likely that Attila's supply lines were overstretched and his army was suffering from disease, and anyway, an Eastern Roman expedition had crossed the Danube to threaten Attila's home base in what's now Hungary. Attila, mercifully for the Western Empire, died in 453 from a bloody nose following yet another wedding celebration, and his empire immediately fractured. Aetius took advantage of this respite, turning his energy and attention toward Iberia, where he signed a new treaty with the Sueves that pulled them out of southern Spain and directed the Visigoths in a campaign that returned Tarraconensis on the Mediterranean coast to direct Roman rule. The good times didn't last long, though. The very next year, in 454, Aetius was assassinated by the Emperor Valentinian III himself. Soon after, in 455, two of Aetius's former soldiers got their revenge and assassinated Valentinian III in return.
Have you ever covered a carpet stain with a rug? Ignored a leaky faucet? Pretended your half-painted living room is supposed to look like that? Well, you're not alone. We've all got unfinished home projects. But there's an easier way. When you download Thumbtack, it's easier to care for your home from top to bottom. Pull out your phone and in just a few steps, you can search, chat, and book highly rated pros right in your neighborhood. Plus, you'll know what to tackle next, because Thumbtack is the app that shows you what to do, who to hire, and when. So say goodbye to all those unfinished home projects and say hello to caring for your home the easier way. Download Thumbtack and start a project today.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases. The time is now more than ever to embrace the breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that can enthrall you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped, like Amy Tintera's Listen for the Lie. With exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors, captivating sound design, and dynamic performances, Audible brings these stories to life like never before. And as a member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
Chaos reigned, and all of Aetius's work came undone almost immediately. The Vandals had been bound by treaty and future marriage alliance to Valentinian III himself, and with him out of the picture, their connection to the imperial court was likewise severed. Just 3 months after Valentinian III was assassinated, the Vandal fleet appeared off the coast of Italy. They landed near Rome, and the usurper who had replaced the murdered emperor was torn to pieces by the Roman mob. The Vandals then proceeded to live up to their name and sacked Rome far more viciously than the Goths had done 45 years earlier. Into this breach stepped a Gallic aristocrat by the name of Avitus, a blue blood connected to some of the oldest, richest, and most prestigious families of that region. We've already met Avitus' son-in-law and younger relatives in the course of this show in the form of Sidonius Apollinaris and all of the other Gallic elite that we've discussed. And this Avitus represents the last real attempt by a provincial aristocrat to insert himself into the high politics at the very center of the empire. The fact that Avitus did that by allying himself with the Visigoths of Toulouse shows just how different the political situation was in 455 than it had been 50 years earlier. This wasn't a frontier general being proclaimed emperor by his army and then setting out for Italy, but a provincial aristocrat allying with a semi-independent kingdom inside Rome's borders to make a play for control of the central government. As much as he could, Avitus was doing his best to restore imperial rule. He was trying to put together a campaign in Spain, again with Gothic support, and seems to have been planning to eventually take back Africa, or at least bring Gaiseric and the Vandals to heel. It didn't work. The campaigns in Spain were strikingly successful, crushing the Sueves and forcing them back to their strongholds in the northwest, but Avitus just couldn't maintain his hold on Italy. Either the generals of the Italian army rebelled, forcing Avitus to retreat back to Arles, or Avitus went to Arles and then the generals rebelled. Either way, Avitus was defeated in battle, captured, and died a month later under suspicious circumstances. Now, the man who replaced Avitus as emperor was a capable one, Majorian, who had been one of those rebellious generals in Italy. He was an experienced and talented soldier and showed his quality quickly, beating off an Alemannic attack on Raetia, modern Austria, and then heading across the Alps to Gaul. There, Majorian, surprisingly considering his treatment of the Gallic emperor Avitus, won the support of the Gallic aristocracy and incorporated what military forces he could muster throughout the region. He even made a stab into Spain in 460 and was planning on attacking Africa. But somehow, Gaiseric, the Vandal king, pulled a rabbit out of the hat and burned the Roman fleet, putting an end to that plan and forcing Majorian to make peace under humiliating terms. That was the end of Majorian, who was executed by his right-hand man, the Magister Militum, Master of Soldiers, Ricimer. Now, this Ricimer is an interesting character. He's something of a transitional figure between the Roman state of affairs and that of the successor kingdoms. He was the son of the Suevic king Recila and the daughter of the Visigothic king Wallia, while his sister was married to the Burgundian king Gundioc, but he himself was a professional Roman soldier. He had a career not unlike that of Stilicho or Aetius. Unfortunately, Ricimer's puppet emperor, Libius Severus, found absolutely no support in the far reaches of Gaul, and Ricimer had to entice the Visigoths to support him by handing over to them the city of Narbonne. Trying to reconstruct precisely what was happening in northern Gaul at this point is pretty much pointless, but the best interpretation involves a series of warlords, some of them of Roman background and some of them Franks or Burgundians, with more or less official positions and connections to the central government, all constantly fighting each other and occasionally the Visigoths. Now, Libius Severus died in 465 and wasn't replaced until 467, which I think says a very great deal about the value of the imperial throne at that point in time. The next emperor, though, was a capable guy. His name was Anthemius, and he was an experienced soldier connected to the Theodosian dynasty. He was effectively imposed on the west by the eastern emperor Leo, and Ricimer had little choice but to accept him. Gaul was a mess, and Spain was as well. Both of those concerns were secondary, though. If the Western Empire could somehow manage to retake Africa and reestablish itself on firm financial footing, the other provinces would surely follow shortly thereafter. To that end, Anthemius and Leo assembled a huge fleet and an army at enormous, ruinous expense. This was the last, best hope for defeating the Vandals and reclaiming the essential African provinces. Alas, it wasn't to be. The invasion force had some initial successes, but the Vandal king Gaiseric always had an ace up his sleeve. This time, it was fire ships, which he loosed into the huge Roman armada and destroyed most of the fleet. The invasion was over and done with before it ever really got off the ground, and the expense of it nearly bankrupted the Eastern Empire for a generation. The defeat of the invasion force in 468 didn't do Anthemius any good either, but he was far from done as an emperor. In fact, he had some surprising successes in the next couple of years, and even sent an army to Gaul under his son in 471. That army was to be one prong of a two-pronged attack on the Visigothic kingdom, which had recently come under the rule of the steely, aggressive King Euric, who had murdered his brother Theodoric II in 466 to take the throne. The second prong of the attack on the Visigoths was to be led by a Briton named Riothamus. We don't know much about this Riothamus aside from the fact that he'd come over to Gaul from Britain. He may have been a British emigre leading an army of Gauls, or he might represent the last fleeting remnants of a Roman army presence in Britain peeking out at us from the dark, misty decades between the usurpation of Constantine III and 471. Unfortunately for Anthemius, neither his sons nor Riothamus's prong of the attack on the Visigoths succeeded. Anthemius's son was killed, and Riothamus was defeated. Back in Italy, this was all the excuse Ricimer needed to try to rid himself of Anthemius. Ricimer besieged him in Rome in 472 and eventually captured Anthemius, who had disguised himself as a beggar, to try to escape the city. It didn't work. Ricimer's nephew Gundobad, a Burgundian prince and Ricimer's right-hand man, captured Anthemius and beheaded him. Ricimer didn't survive long after this, dying of a hemorrhage shortly after the execution of Anthemius, and his new puppet emperor Olybrius died soon as well. This left Gundobad in effective charge, and in 473, he found another puppet emperor in a man named Glycerius. This didn't last long either. Glycerius's reign is mostly notable for the first mentions of the Ostrogoths, another Gothic group that had been under the rule of the Hunnic Empire for the last century inside the Roman Empire. They'll become important in a little while, you'll see why. Glycerius abdicated and became a bishop in 474 when the general Julius Nepos, with the backing of the eastern emperor Zeno, brought an army to Italy and declared himself emperor. At this point, the Burgundian Gundobad decided he'd had enough. He went home to Gaul and took a stab at becoming king of the Burgundians, his people, and succeeded. We'll meet him again later. Now, I think it says a very great deal about the state of affairs in 474 that Glycerius was happy to trade being the emperor for being a bishop, and that Gundobad thought it was better to make a run at becoming a Burgundian king than remaining the power behind the Western throne. Africa was formally ceded to the Vandals around this time, ending 40 years of on-again, off-again conflict. Nepos gave it his best shot, but the Visigothic King Euric had conquered Provence and the Auvergne with its city of Clermont and its bishop Sidonius Apollinaris. Barely a year later, Nepos fled Italy when the Italian army rebelled under the leadership of a man named Orestes, who put his son, Romulus Augustulus, on the throne. Just a year after that, though, the Italian army rebelled again and put its general Odoacer in charge. Romulus Augustulus was deposed and given a pension and some land in southern Italy, where apparently he was still to be found living happily in the early 6th century. For all intents and purposes, the game was up in 476. This is the traditional end date for the Western Empire, the one you'd give if you were asked on a high school history test or Jeopardy, but in the context of this political narrative, it makes perfect sense. Odoacer had himself a little back and forth with the Eastern Emperor Zeno and said he was quite happy to rule Italy for Zeno, whether as a simple patrician or perhaps a king. The deposed Nepos still claimed to be emperor, but nobody was paying attention anymore, and he was murdered anyway in 480. So let's take stock of where we stand here in 480, at the death of Nepos and the last even somewhat plausible claim to the Western Empire. The Visigoths, the first of the new successor kingdoms, rule in southern Gaul. Their kingdom stretches from the Loire River in the north to the Rhone in the east, from the Atlantic coast along the Bay of Biscay to Arles along the Mediterranean. The Visigoths will shortly acquire some territory in Iberia as well, but a combination of Roman aristocrats turned warlords and the Sueves rule the peninsula for the time being. Britain has been out of Roman control for a century, and Anglo-Saxon and Romano-British, soon just British, warlords have carved it up amongst themselves. Soon, true kingdoms will begin to emerge from the ashes of Roman Britain. Northern Gaul is a confused mess of competing armies, some of them led by Romans, others by Franks, and it's around this time that these competing armies are beginning to call their leaders kings. The Burgundians have a kingdom in Gaul as well, one centered on the cities of Lyon, Vienne, and Geneva. Noricum and Raetia, parts of modern Switzerland and Austria, have been completely overrun by barbarians, and we have no real idea from a textual perspective what's happening there. North Africa is the core of a powerful, sophisticated, and wealthy Vandal kingdom that exports goods all over the Western Mediterranean. Italy is still home to a cultured and wealthy aristocracy, but its ruler is a general turned king by the name of Odoacer. Soon, he'll be out of a job, replaced by the Ostrogoths of Theodoric the Great. I want to end this episode with a quote from Guy Halza, who I think wrote the best narrative account of this whole messy period. Contemporaries did mark the empire's passing in the years around 476, he says, because, quote, the empire had not died quietly. It went down kicking, gouging, and screaming. Next time, we'll take a more structural and institutional approach to understanding this calamitous 5th century, and after that, we'll explore each of these new barbarian kingdoms and what kind of world they built for themselves on the foundations of the Roman Empire. Thank you for joining me for today's episode. If you have a spare moment, I'd appreciate it if you left a rating and a review. You can follow me on Twitter at Patrick_Wyman or on Facebook at PatrickWymanMMA. And if you have questions, comments, or concerns, or if you just want to chat a bit about the fall of the Roman Empire, please go ahead, drop me a line. If you want to help me out even a bit more, I'd really appreciate it if you took the survey at wondery.com/survey. That's wondery.com/survey. If you're looking for more history podcasts, check out History Matters on iTunes and SoundCloud. A historian friend of mine and I, Keith Plimers, are talking about present-day issues and historical perspective, tackling topics like political breakdown, settlement patterns, globalization, and much, much more. Thanks again for listening. Until next time, this has been The Fall of Rome.